All right. So I thought that I would start, Senator Booker, by telling you something.
Are you going to really go through this whole podcast with you calling me Senator Booker? I mean, you got one sort of obligatory Senator Booker in. Please, Corey.
I'm Tali Farhadian Weinstein, and this is Hearing. Some guests need very little introduction, and today's guest is one of those. Corey Booker has done it all. He started out in local government, where, among other things, he went on a hunger strike as a member of the Newark City Council to protest housing inequality. These days, he's doing things like passing major criminal justice reform legislation in the United States Senate. You'll hear us talk about all of that in this interview, but we'll also discuss how childhood experiences inform the people we grow up to become, for better or for worse. And speaking of formative experiences, I began our conversation by telling Corey about the first time we met, a moment I've carried with me ever since it happened.
Okay, so Corey, I'm going to take you back to the late 90s when we met.
When I had a great afro.
You did, although this is also very becoming. And you said some things to me then when we first met in our first conversation, which I wouldn't expect you to remember. You know, you were sort of big man on campus in the law school. And
that's just because I'm 6'3". Other than that, it was not that big.
Like literally. And I was applying for the Rhodes Scholarship in New Jersey. And back then, the first interview you had was in front of a state committee. And someone had set us up. And you are such a mensch that you stayed on the phone with me for hours, talking me through, getting me ready for this interview. And I remember you said something to me that sort of shocked me at the time, because my politics were not there to really understand the world this way. And you said to me, you should think about how they are going to underestimate you and walk into the room already responding to it. And you said about yourself, well, you know, I was a great athlete at Stanford. Maybe you didn't say great in quite that way. And I thought that they might think they're getting a dumb jock. And it helped me a lot in that moment. And it's helped me in the years since. So I wanted to ask you about that. Do you still think about being underestimated or overestimated? And does it affect the way you walk into the world, walk into the room?
I think that in that part of my life, I definitely felt that, sort of being a young Black man in America who then, unlike now, had a very overt physical prowess when you walk into. I used to be chiseled. Now I just jiggle. But but I definitely was constantly encountering how the world saw me, which was often as a threat or scary, you know, big Black guy, or ascribing to me certain traits that were underestimating a lot of the other aspects of my being. And so it was good to sort of be aware of that and to anticipate that. But also, you know, my parents were like that. I still remember as a kid, and I didn't get it till I was older, about how much time my parents spent at the school, because they were worried that the implicit biases of teachers about this Black boy in a math class, you know, in the same way that they would have been if they had daughters, I'm sure, about the gender biases that are there. So I think that by the time I was in my late 20s, around the time we were having this conversation, I was very much aware of needing to have coping strategies for how I was perceived by others.
Mm-hmm. And to use it as a kind of power, I think, because I actually found it very empowering as advice to anticipate and to outfox.
Look, you were clearly, I think the reason why I was excited, not just that you were applying for the Rhodes in my state, but that I knew you enough to see in you such extraordinary greatness. And I was just very energized by your promise, frankly, as a person and knowing you as a classmate. And so I'm flattered and humbled that you remember that as words that were meaningful to you. And I think that this is something that I have to remind myself all the time, which is, I think we always underestimate the differences we can make in the world. I've come to say, I have a saying now that I tell people all the time, which is never forget that the biggest thing you can do in most of your days on this planet is a small act of kindness, decency, or love. And my chief of staff and I talk about this all the time. as a senator because I have these daily interactions and I forget how I was at 22 years old. The first time I came into the very building I'm sitting in right now, I was on my way to Oxford. And one of my friends said, hey, go meet this other Rhodes Scholar, a guy named Bill Bradley, the senator then in New Jersey. And it was one of the few times I was sort of starstruck. And I remember sitting on his couch in an office similar to this one, and just how much import it was, what he was saying to me. And so I never try to get into a point in my life where I forget the power you could have by just giving somebody a kind word or a bit of encouragement. So I just hope we all recognize our power to make a difference and don't miss out on the opportunities to exercise that power.
Yeah. And I would add just to that, that I think it feels good to walk into the world with love. And I want to ask you about that because I also once heard you tell this story. It was on Ezra Klein's podcast about when you were on a hunger strike, I think. Also, I think in the late 90s or close Newark, and you hugged Sharp James, who wound up being your opponent in a mayoral race there. And you said something about how he smelled. Do you remember that story? Could you tell it?
I remember that because my editor almost wanted me to take that out of my book because it just sounded weird. But it was a powerful moment in my life where I had been for 10 days on this hunger strike, praying and fasting. And this guy who had been tormenting my life, I mean, Sharp James was a fierce competitor even then. Mm-hmm. And he was so attacked by the hunger strike because he had left us out there. But by the time we came and met on this pavement, he had this prepared speech at that moment where we were both going to give public speeches, which I thought he thought was going to be tense between us. But when he came into the tent, I hugged him. And I just remember being in a place where when I smelled him, he was the same age as my dad or similar to my father. And I just remember the smell suddenly, wait a minute, this is another human being. He smells like older men in my family. And it was just so comforting and disarming to see his humanity, I guess, to really breathe in his humanity. And it was this elevated spiritual plane that I still aspire to, where I just felt no animosity towards him. And I found myself doing what a lot of our faith traditions say, which is loving your adversary and recognizing their equal dignity and even their divinity. And it's something I always try to remember, even here in the Senate, where, God, I get so angry sometimes at the positions of my adversaries, but we should never dehumanize each other. And I think we really run a risk if we do that. And we should never close off pathways to redemption for people.
Yeah. You know, I bring it up because it's something that I aspire to. It is in our faith traditions. Don't abhor the Edomite because he is your brother, right? Don't abhor the Egyptian because you were a stranger in his land. And yet, Corey, it's hard. It's hard right now to go through the world with compassion and love where there's so much hatred all around us. And you held on to that in the course of your presidential campaign. And I think it's at the core of who you are. But I ask you, do you ever feel like in these days you can't do it or it's not working?
Well, first of all, I count it as one of the blessings of my life that a hero of mine became my colleague. You know, this legend of the civil rights movement that suddenly I was serving next to, John Lewis. And like, there's always this thing, don't meet your heroes, you know? but I've never met a person of faith more so than him that so thoroughly lived their faith. And that doesn't mean he didn't make mistakes in life or slips, but I loved seeing how he dealt with opposition. He wasn't ever weak. He was fierce. He was strong to hear him speak. But you could see that he never lost his love for the people on the other side. And I just remember one of the stories he related to me about one of the people that beat him viciously in the civil rights movement, who eventually would come and ask for his forgiveness for that, that found a long pathway years later to redemption. And so he was just beautiful to me as an example. So for me now, look, I fail every single day to live up to the best of who I am. You know, I gave a commencement speech at UPenn where I talked about a visit to a McDonald's and how I was on the way out of the drive-thru holding on to my two large French fries. This is back when I thought they were vegan, but they're not. they're not vegan. They're not kosher.
Yes. They told us in yeshiva not to eat those French fries.
Yes. And there was a man digging in a trash can, and I know my faith says something about, like, if you have two McDonald's French fries and your neighbor has none, you're supposed to share them. Right. The sermon on the McMount. So I rolled down my window and gave the guy one of my two fries, and he thanked me. And you said it. I felt good about myself, and he felt good. But then he asks me this question. He goes, "Do you have any socks?" And I remember looking at him, knowing that, God, this guy must have something going on with his feet, and he wouldn't be asking if it wasn't something urgent about that. And I just said to the guy, "I'm sorry, no, I don't carry extra socks in my car." And the guy that was driving me, I turned to him to, like, look straight, thinking he'll drive now. The next thing I know, the driver of my car is reaching between the steering wheel and his legs to pull off his socks and give them to the man. It was such a powerful moment of radical love, but yet so simple in action, but so powerfully penetrating to spirit. Now, this McDonald's was three blocks from where I live. I probably have socks in my house that I don't even wear, but I didn't have the moral imagination in that moment to see what the driver of my car saw in that moment. And I think the one thing I tell people all the time is you don't have to be perfect, but you have to be wrestling with these issues. The second you stop wrestling with the call to be a better person, then I think that's when we fail. We don't fail when we stumble, but we fail when we stop trying.
You know, I have to tell you, Corey, a story that brings to mind. So right after Hurricane Maria, I went to Puerto Rico with my mom and one of my girls and some friends on a mission to take some medical supplies. But we also, we went to a small town, to Louisa, to distribute, you know, just, you know, basic necessities like coloring books for the kids and formula for the babies and all of this. So we're there and they told us to dress for, you know, the mud and the rain and all the aftermaths, because it was really just quite soggy, even in the weeks after. And so we're there in our rubber boots and we're handing out this stuff. And we see this little old lady and she's got like flip-flops on, basically. And we're handing her things that she doesn't really need in the way that she needs a sturdy pair of shoes. And my mom just took her boots off. I mean, I really couldn't believe it. And handed them to this woman and was left in her socks. So she went home in her socks. Wow. And like, of course, it's like, doesn't seem like such a big deal, but I didn't think to do it. And she knew to just do it. So, you know, part of it is just, I think, also keeping our eyes open.
Yeah, but God, I have this saying, and this is why I look forward to witnessing your children to become adults themselves. Because James Baldwin said, children are never good at listening to their elders, but they never fail to imitate them. And so their grandmother, they got your daughter, got to witness the way we should live. And I'm here today because in 1965, 4 years before I was born, a white man on a couch in New Jersey was watching TV on March 7th, 1965, and was shaken when he saw the breaking news of the Edmund Pettus Bridge and the beating of John Lewis and the marchers on the Edmund. And he was so shaken that he wanted to get up and go to Alabama, but he was just struggling to make it. He was just started his business, couldn't do it. And so he decided that he could afford maybe 1 hour a week of pro bono work to help on civil rights issues. Got involved with a group called the New Jersey Fair Housing Council. And he said 4 years later, he gets this case of a family moving up from the South who can't find homes to live in the northern New Jersey areas where they had the best, highest ranking public schools. They kept getting turned away from housing and housing discrimination. And they went on to represent this family. He said they got white couples to pose as them. And they eventually, through a lot of legal issues, even a physical attack, they were able to finally get this family into this house. And they grew up in that house. And that family's me and my parents. I was just a baby. And so my parents would remind me, here's a guy that just decided to give 1 hour a week. And he changed my destiny. I'm a United States senator because of all the dominoes that fell because this man gave a little bit more. So it's just powerful when you when we often forget what those small actions can do.
And you know, you talk about that pro bono lawyer being responsible for you being here and in this conversation. And Corey, my family was represented by pro bono lawyers for 10 years in our immigration case. Absolutely. The day after we arrived in America, my mom knew someone who helped her to call the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, and they stayed with us for a decade until we got amnesty. And I think about that, you know, a lot, an hour here and an hour there. like the pair of shoes.
And so I'll tell you how blessed I feel. Arthur Lessman is that lawyer on the couch. Mm. I live my whole life. I'm a United States Senator, and I call him up. He's 84 years old. And I thank God I had that conversation because he would die soon after. But to tell him how grateful I was for him changing the destiny of my family.
I'm so happy that you got to do that.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's hard to move from the light to the dark, but we have to, you know, we are here and we are both trying to fight for something. And I do want to talk to you about some of our shared goals around racial justice and criminal justice reform and this moment that we find ourselves in. And so, you know, this is, I think, the last time I'm going to bring you back to something brilliant that you did back in the 90s, because I know you've done a lot of important things since. But I was looking at something that you wrote after the acquittal of the police officers who assaulted Rodney King, which is, I think, a moment that a lot of people are sort of looking back to. And, you know, you had a kind of fury. You said, "Our cities are stacks of dry leaves and lumber waiting for a spark. This is but a mere campfire compared to the potential inferno awaiting us." And that was 30 years ago. And you wrote in this thing that your hands were shaking when you wrote it. And I wanted to ask you, Corey, are your hands shaking now?
That column was reprinted by Stanford after the killing of Ahmaud Arbery. And it really was very emotional to me that weeks after his death, because I was forced to confront with a lot of other Black men my age that this awful tradition, this cycle is repeating itself of young African-Americans being raised by elders who have to teach them survival skills that the rest of the country doesn't have to experience. And it shook me again during that period where I watched everything from a interaction in Central Park, horrible racist interaction in Central Park, to George Floyd. All of these moments were really sort of reopening wounds that had never really fully healed. And so, yeah, the stunning thing about that column that's entitled "Why Have I Lost Control" was, for me, that you could take out the name Rodney King and substitute something else. And I think there's a line in there about, unless one small part of your everyday reality is captured on videotape, and the article could still stands the test of time. The 23-year-old me, as you said, it still applies to the experiences now, even though I'm now in my early 50s.
And it's all the more devastating now, because now you're calling living with this a kind of tradition. You just use that word. I mean, it like a wave of, you know, kind of like a disgust just came up through me. Like, how can this be so locked in? But Corey, when you wrote that, you were at the beginning, and you were a student, and you were on the outside, and you were an activist, and now you're working inside the system. You've described the criminal justice system as broken. That's the system in which I'm trying to work. And I want to ask you, is it viable to do reform from within, and is it ethical?
You can absolutely make change. It may not be the full revolution we are looking for in terms of creating an entirely new system, but everything you do in the cause of justice makes a difference to somebody. Look, the criminal justice reform bill that we passed here in the Senate that I worked on for 2+ Congresses that finally got done led to the liberation of thousands of people from prison. 90% plus of them were African American. So to them, my efforts may not have changed the whole system, but to their families and to them, it made a difference. So we have a long way to go to change, but I definitely believe I'm in the right place doing the right thing. And this country needs everything. It needs the external advocates marching and demanding change. And it needs the stalwart people who are willing to go through elections and the fights to win popular support to be inside the mechanisms of power and in the rooms where it happens, as Hamilton says, to make the change.
Yeah. That legislation, the First Step Act, it felt like a miracle. Tell me what's next in your ambitions for criminal justice reform at the federal level.
Well, the policing reform bill that got stopped by Mitch McConnell, the pass out of the House with bipartisan support, is the next thing. We need to ban the chokeholds that killed Eric Garner, ban the no-knock warrants that killed Breonna Taylor, ban a lot of these practices. We need to make sure that when police break the law or violate civil rights, that you can actually hold them accountable, that we get rid of qualified immunity and the impossible criminal standards that make it very hard to prosecute. We need to create a lot more transparency that forces police departments to be more accountable by publishing their statistics on their the number of people of color that they're stopping and mm-hmm. what happens with the police misconduct cases that they have, document the use of police use of forces that they have. So independent groups from the ACLU, just concerned citizens, can do that. So I think the next thing that will pass in criminal justice reform will be the policing bill that Kamala mm-hmm. and I worked on the Senate side, mm-hmm. along with some great House members on the House side.
And alongside your vision for criminal justice reform at the federal level, I know that you know, and you came up through local politics, that some of the work just has to be done the local level. What do you expect of us?
Well, first of all, I'm so happy you say that because as a guy who was a mayor and a city council person, so much of the things that directly affect your lives are most controlled by your local officials, from your school board members all the way to your local mayor. And if you're not actively participating in that world, then you are complicit in the status quo, remaining the status quo. And the people that you elect on the local level, holding them accountable, is just so important. So that's what I would say that I would want to see.
Yeah. And look, as you know, and you've done all this work on prison liberation, 80% of the people who are incarcerated right now are sitting in a state or local jail or prison.
Yes.
So we have to reinforce each other. I will share with you, though, something that frustrates me sometimes is that we enter as prosecutors after all of the tragedies have happened, or at least after so many tragedies have happened. And, you know, sometimes I just wish that people sitting in other seats of power would do some of the work to make our work less necessary. You know, when I was a gang prosecutor for years, the way you build gang cases is you have to have cooperating witnesses. These are not like paper cases, and you need people inside, you know, the organizations to tell you what somebody else was doing. And so you have to really get to know people who have lived this life really well. It's, you know, something that somebody doesn't tell you. You have to spend hours sitting with them. And the sort of the basic deal is that they tell you everything that they've ever done wrong in exchange for you advocating for them to get a lighter sentence in the federal system. And at a certain point, my heart just broke when I just realized the answer to the following question was always going to be the same. When I would ask what was the first crime you committed, it invariably had to do with stealing food. And I don't say that to excuse or, you know, like, I don't want to spin out something bigger from that than there is, other than to say it always started with stealing food. I went to get something from my mom. My mom needed something from the store. It was embarrassing that she couldn't put it on the table. So I thought it was my responsibility to be a man and to go get it from her. And these were people who had murdered other people, Corey, by the time I was meeting them.
Your point is so powerful. I mean, I remember sitting with the head of the FBI in the state of New Jersey, and we were talking about gang violence, and he was giving me intelligence reports. And I just said to him very purposefully, I said, how do we solve this problem of gangs and gang violence? And he looks at me like I asked a crazy question. He's like, we don't solve this problem. And really what he was getting at was that by the time law enforcement is involved, the problems of our society that we fail to confront and deal with have so festered that they've now exploded onto all of us. And it is just cruel that we don't do common sense things. I mean, just think as simple as replacing all the lead service lines in our country, because lead poisoning, one of the things it does is it permanently damages the brain. And one of the parts of your brain it damages is the executive function, which controls impulse control. I mean, there are so many things that we know and documented that could lower crime that happened way before we even get to a point where we need prosecutors and judges and police and federal authorities, et cetera.
And let me just interrupt you to say, and it's not just to interrupt the person who would perpetrate the crime. I was shocked to learn this in Wes Moore's book that Freddie Gray had been exposed to so much lead poisoning as a kid. And all of that had led him to that moment too.
Yes. I mean, that's the thing, is we're so callous that we do not see the trauma that children are going through, preventable trauma that children are going through, from poverty, from evictions, from external toxins in your air and your water, from the violence that they witness in our communities and our streets. There's so much that's going on in our children's lives that we don't understand. Simple policy changes, expanding the earned income tax credit, expanding prenatal care, are all things that we know factually reduce levels of violence and engagement with police. Something called nurse-family partnerships have been shown to dramatically lower a child's future involvement with police. But yet we don't invest in these things. They're cheaper, frankly, than courts, prisons, jails, police. And that is, I think, something we need to be calling for as a society much more dramatically. We tolerate the violence against children. Toxins in their systems is violence. Poverty is violence. Lack of access to healthcare is violence. We tolerate all that violence, and then somehow we act shocked or surprised when they manifest violence in their own lives.
We're probably up against your time. I mean, obviously, I could talk to you all day, but I made some promises to some very important people.
Yeah, well, I hope this is not the last time I get invited to have this conversation with you. You know I enjoy it.
I would love to have it with the recording on and off. It really is such a pleasure.
God willing, we get to do it in person the next time.
Imagine that.
Yes.
Hearing is produced in partnership with Pushkin Industries. Our producers are Sam Dingman and Camille Baptista. Our engineer is Evan Viola. Special thanks to Malcolm Gladwell and Jacob Weisberg. This podcast is paid for by New Yorkers for Tali, and Senator Booker's appearance on the show does not constitute a political endorsement. I am running to be District Attorney of Manhattan and to set a national example in delivering safety, fairness, and justice for all, especially our most vulnerable. If you like what you've heard, go to tali4da.com to learn more about my campaign. I'm Tali Farhadian Weinstein. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you next time on Hearing.